Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. You'd have listened to our podcast yesterday on the South China Sea and how China's all of a sudden becoming more assertive while the world battles a global pandemic. And you'd also have noticed, if you're following the international news, how on two sides of the world, two superpowers, both supposedly engaged in a war of words, are also apparently engaged in a war against their own citizens. China is brutally cracking down on protesters in Hong Kong, and the US is being widely condemned by a lot of European countries, its erstwhile partners, for police brutality against peaceful protesters. I'm not sure when we'll be doing a podcast about the way the American police and their protesters work, but we have definitely been tracking Hong Kong very closely here at Takshashila. So to discuss what is really happening in Hong Kong, the causes for the new wave of protests, and whether it's really a good idea from the Chinese regime's perspective, and what the prognosis is for the people of Hong Kong, I have with me Manoj Kewalramani and Rohan Seth. So let's just have a bit of background first, guys. So you guys have recently written a report on radically networked societies and the case of Hong Kong, talking about how the connectedness of Hong Kong, as it were, really helped people rapidly mobilize and come up with innovative new responses to police brutality. So can you tell us a little bit about the causes for unrest in Hong Kong in the first place, a little bit about how protests in Hong Kong were leading up to the pandemic, and then we can talk about the newest wave of unrest that started there?
Yeah, sure. So with regard to the causes of unrest in Hong Kong, I think this is part of a larger pattern that can, I think, in recent memory, we at least trace back to changes in the Chinese syllabus at the time when Joshua Wong was a student. And and more recently, in 2019, we see protests against the extradition bill and the fact that, you know, the Chinese public was going to interfere more in Hong Kong's autonomy. So it was sort of an erosion of the one country, two systems framework that was established in the Basic Law. And so this has been part of a larger pattern where we see Hong Kong's autonomy being systemically eroded by China. And this brings us to today, because when we were analyzing the developments in the Hong Kong protests and using a radically networked society framework to make sense of what was happening, the conclusion that we inevitably came to was that China's response towards the developments in Hong Kong have been rooted in a strategy of attrition. That is, by having repeated attacks on Hong Kong's autonomy to wear down, you know, the current framework that exists under the one country, two systems under the Basic Law. So, yeah.
Yeah, if I could just add to that, the idea that, you know, in many ways, this is inbuilt in the way the system has been structured in 1997 when you had the handover of Hong Kong. Rohan mentioned the Basic Law. That was sort of a mini constitution for Hong Kong, for people who might not know, which essentially guarantees autonomy for Hong Kong. Therefore, Hong Kong has a separate immigration system, separate currency from the mainland, separate judicial system, a separate legislature. And there is somewhat of an electoral process in Hong Kong, unlike what happens in the mainland. So therefore, it's distinct. It retains its sort of characteristics of what it was like under British rule. And that's the sort of autonomy that was supposed to be with Hong Kong for a period of 50 years from the handover. Now, ever since that handover happened, there has been a push and pull. Hong Kong is a special administrative region within the PRC. And there's been an effort by the PRC every, so often to sort of structurally erode that autonomy because of the fact that it feels a sense of, increasingly so, it feels a sense of threat from Hong Kong. Now, in the initial years, there was a sense that, right, if this one country, two systems formula, this sort of autonomy can be successful, can make sense, can still sort of reduce the threats for the mainland in terms of losing territories that are its. Then that could be something that could be pitched as a model to Taiwan. But unfortunately for the Chinese, for the PRC, ever since this sort of process has unfolded in the last 23 years, what we've seen is that increasingly Hong Kong's autonomy has been encroached upon. And as that's happened, the people have pushed back. There have been repeated pushbacks over the years. Rohan talked about the education curriculum reform, which sort of was, there was an effort at introducing sort of patriotic education, which there was a pushback to. There has been an effort in sort of introducing a national security law, which currently is the problem, in 2003. And there was a pushback, and that was the government walked back at that point of time. The Hong Kong government had attempted this and it walked back. Subsequently, last year, there was an extradition bill which would have legalized extradition to the mainland on a case-by-case basis. And there was that sort of sparked widespread protests. This was building because in 2014, there was a massive movement called the Umbrella Movement, which was a product of the Chinese legislature passing norms for elections in Hong Kong, which essentially rigged the game in favor of a Beijing candidate for the chief executive of Hong Kong. And people therefore protested for genuine sort of free and fair democratic elections. None of that's happened. But that for 2014 sort of anger morphed into this 2019 anti-extradition movement. And today this national security law is sort of, we're at an inflection point in some ways, in which this is Beijing now saying that we are going to go ahead with this. In theory, what they're saying is that we're doing this to protect the two systems structure because national security is a national issue. But in practice, what's going to happen is that it's going to increase Beijing's control over Hong Kong. And that will sort of undermine the autonomy that's been guaranteed.
This brings up a lot of questions now. Some of them are fairly basic. Some of them, I think, I'll bring them in through this conversation. But first, Manoj, I want to understand a little better why the PRC is so threatened by the one country, two systems way of working of things. Why is it so important for it to be continually kind to trying to adopt the strategy of attrition, as Rohan puts it? Why is it constantly eroding these freedoms? Does it follow a similar policy with Macau, for example?
Yes, it does. So, and Macau has not had the kind of focus, the kind of investment that Hong Kong has, and the kind of sort of expatriate population. Macau is not a financial center. It's essentially a resort town sort of urban region. And those elements, I mean, as the communists in the PRC grew comfortable with wealth, they also grew comfortable with vices like gambling, which previously would have been seen as a complete no-no. And they've sort of, Macau has been pitched as the Vegas of the East and those sorts of things. And Macau has been less, the pushback from Macau has been less. Hong Kong's been the heart of all of this. And it's because of the history of Hong Kong in terms of how it came about, how the transfer came about. And also this entire argument of the British sort of pushing for this autonomy. In terms of the other sort of issue of why attrition, that is the most sensible strategy from the PRC's sort of perspective. I mean, if you have a territory where you feel, and this is what their narrative has been, and I presume this is partly also because they genuinely feel the sense of threat, that there are external forces that are promoting secessionism in Hong Kong. And there is a reason for the Chinese to be this anxious. I think it's overplayed, but there is a reason for it. If you look through the protests that happened last year, you had people marching with the colonial flag of Hong Kong. You had people marching up to the U.S. embassy with American flags saying, liberate us. Those things give pretext to the Chinese to crack down more. As any authoritarian regime, which sees the fact that, you know, if people sitting in the mainland, when you look across, across Shenzhen into Hong Kong, and when you look at the territory and you see people voicing criticism, dissent against the central government and the central government not being able to do anything about it, there is a fear that that could lead to sort of contagion within the PRC. Therefore, you would want to bring these dissident elements to heel. That's from a regime's point of view. Any authoritarian regime would want to have that control. And the second bit is obviously the threat that this could foment secessionism. At the moment, if you look at most polls done in Hong Kong, there is a very, very, very small fraction of people who would even talk about independence. Everybody is essentially talking about autonomy. That's what they want. But that's not the narrative that suits the Chinese regime, right? So there, they have pitched it as foreign black hands raising storms and these sorts of things in Hong Kong in a bid to sort of promote secessionism. And some of the
activities
that have taken place, the fact that, you know, Hong Kong's pro-democracy activists have traveled to Europe and capitals in Europe and DC and gone and pitched for intervention of some sort or the other, or pressure for some sort or the other. It would be very difficult for any regime to brook that. But a regime which is authoritarian, whose impulse is control, it would be very, very difficult for them to do this. And therefore, you end up sort of tying yourself up in knots to the point where today you're trying to implement a law which is going to create greater problems for you. I think the attrition part is largely to do with, last year there was a lot of talk about sending in the PLA inside Hong Kong. But that would be a very high cost move to do on many fronts. And therefore, the appropriate strategy from their point of view would be attrition, because you gradually erode the legitimacy of the protests. You inform, you sort of make the costs of these protests higher, and therefore people choose either not to or stop supporting them. And that's the whole objective of this attrition strategy, and that's what's playing out even with the NatSec law.
That makes a lot of sense. One of the most surreal moments for me watching this whole thing has been the UK trying to portray itself as being relevant in all of this, claiming that it's going to do all it can to guarantee that China sticks to the terms of its agreement and all that, which really seems like the British trying to feel and seem relevant when they really aren't. But let's come back to the national security law, right? It seems to have pretty severe penalties for what might seem relatively minor offenses, like disrespecting the Chinese flag, stuff like that. But it's not coming out of nowhere, right? So, I mean, I believe that through this whole pandemic and the lockdowns that have been imposed, China's steadily been advancing more and more severe laws. And the current wave of unrest that we're seeing seems to be ostensibly a reaction to the national security law, but it's really been kind of bubbling away there for a while. So can you guys tell us a little bit about how the pandemic has affected Hong Kong and where exactly this national security law is coming from?
Sure. I mean, I want to first talk about the penalties that actually may not look so justified on the surface, but actually fit part of a larger pattern. Because if you if you've been actually following news on Hong Kong, there has been a recent scandal in 2018 called the Oath Gate. So the idea is that you have a body in Hong Kong called the Legislative Council, which is the region's legislative body, and a lot of it is actually constituted by pro Beijing people, and it doesn't actually always get. The body itself is not constituted on the basis of universal suffrage per se. You have these things called functional constituencies. So the idea is that interest groups such as bankers and traders can actually, and who have historically been pre-Beijing, they constitute most of it. But recently you had a wave of pro-democracy candidates actually making it to the Legislative Council. And so you're supposed to take an oath while you're signing in. And some of the pro-democracy people took an oath that appeared fairly dissenting of the Chinese or the Communist Party and China itself. And what ended up happening was that those people, after being elected through suffrage, were banned from being, from taking part in the Legislative Council. So it's actually offenses like these do attract a huge penalty from China. And this is not just in the case of the national security law, but has been sort of happening for a while now. And I think that's just China's way of dealing with things. Also, the question you asked right now about using this pandemic to actually upping the pressure on Hong Kong, that was actually one of my first questions to Manoj when I heard about the national security law. And does this seem a bit opportunistic for China, given that they're using this pandemic as an excuse? And the response I got from Manoj was that they're using this as an excuse to double down. So I think Manoj will say more about that. But I agree with the general idea. It's that maybe not being opportunistic it may not be the right word. I think the idea is that the Chinese are using this to double down and make their case in Hong Kong while the world is looking else.
But I mean, the world isn't really looking elsewhere anymore, though, is it? But we'll come back to it in a second. Manoj, you had something?
Yeah, I mean, the thought is that, look, the reason that I don't say this is an opportunistic move, I mean, in part, there is opportunism, right? So, for example, when you're banning public gatherings, when you're saying that, you know, the June 4th vigils in Hong Kong to mark the Tiananmen Square massacre anniversary cannot be held because of social distancing and so on and so forth. That's a little, you know, that's clearly opportunistic. I mean, Hong Kong has not had a case or has had, I mean, Hong Kong's trajectory in terms of dealing with COVID has been really, really good. The caseload is really, really low. Many things are open to the point that even sort of international travel is now set to sort of resume. So Hong Kong's actually been doing quite well with COVID. And there have been protests anyway. So this is slightly opportunistic. But the broader sort of approach in terms of cracking down, imposing the national security law and those sorts of things, I don't see that as opportunistic. I think that as a gradual progression of thinking in Beijing of what they need to do. So last year when the protests were happening, late last year, the Hong Kong police commissioner changed. The new fellow who came in was extremely, very clearly sort of clarified his position that he's going to be very tough on these protests. He quickly went to Beijing soon after taking charge in Hong Kong. And there was a lovely picture of him posted and standing at Tiananmen Square with a Chinese flag behind him, talking about how national security must be sort of protected. And they said that, yes, we'll be adopting hard and soft measures, but, you know, there's a group of rioters whom we'll be dealing with in a tough format. Thousands of people have been arrested. The trials of these people who've been arrested have begun. I think the first case ended just a couple of weeks ago with somebody being given, I think, 4 years in prison, if I'm correct. But that was the first of the trials that the fellow was declared guilty. So this has been a progression. I mean, subsequently, you saw there are two main offices through which Beijing deals with Hong Kong. One is the Hong Kong and Macau Affairs Office, which is based in China. And the other is the Hong Kong Liaison Office, which is based in Hong Kong. And both the representatives, the representative of the liaison office was changed because for being ineffective when you had a Xi Jinping confidant come in. The gentleman who came in was very clear very early on that, you know, we are going to have to protect national security, so we are going to have to do something strict. And in the last couple of weeks, these bodies have become far more active and the messaging from them has been far stronger on national security. In March, they arrested, in late February, they charged Apple Daily's Jimmy Lai for illegal assembly for participating in a protest in August. He was also, you know, identified as one of the new gang of four, which is fueling problems in Hong Kong. Other pro-democracy legislators and other pro-democracy activists have been arrested over the coming sort of next few weeks since late February and April onwards. So there's been a pattern of this toughening. And I think that's where I say that this is doubling down at this point of time as opposed to something new. This was coming. Anybody who's been following Hong Kong for the last year and a half and has been looking at what's been happening in the last 6 months and what Beijing is saying in the last 6 months knew that this was coming. And the moment that Beijing has announced that we will be doing this, there's a very, very remote chance that Beijing will step back. More often than not, once they've made a decision, made an announcement that we plan to do this, they are. It's actually the decision of doing it has already been made. The rest is just due process from Beijing's point of view. So I don't think that there's been any opportunism. They've been telling us very clearly what they want to do. The cost of that is another thing. Is another game, ball game altogether.
So Beijing is determined to push this through no matter what the cost is, what you're saying, Manoj.
What I'm saying is that the cost, I mean, I would think that they would not, unless the cost is extremely high, which at the moment, I think they must have calculated the economic cost. The biggest threat is this, that the fact that the US will not just withdraw Hong Kong's special status, but also impose some kinds of sanctions. We don't know what kind of sanctions. The cost of the withdrawal of the special status, on the face of it, is not significant, at least from China's point of view, from the PRC's point of view. From Hong Kong's point of view, it is significant. From the people of Hong Kong's point of view, it is significant. But if there are additional sanctions, if money is pulled out of Hong Kong, if the economy sort of flatlines even further, given that it's already in the in a very, very bad shape. Those are the kinds of things that will have to be seen. But then the Chinese have the capital to try and support that. And they might actually see that as an opportunity to strengthen their control in Hong Kong financially further.
You talked in your newsletter how Mike Pompeo said that Hong Kong is no longer autonomous. Donald Trump has implied that he's going to be stripping Hong Kong of a lot of the special privileges it once enjoyed. But Chinese authorities at the same time are also kind of going to companies and asking them to take sides, right? You talked about HSBC, for example, where the Chinese have said that, you know, if you don't comply with our rules, then we'll be happy to find another bank who'd be willing to open up business here. So do you think there's this bravado from the Chinese side, or do you think that they genuinely believe that the tightening restrictions in Hong Kong, even at the cost of like creating all these protests, bringing all this international attention, putting economic activity to halt, does it seem like really... It seems like it's worth it to the Chinese. Is that what you're saying?
I think that they've sort of made a calculation saying that we will have to deal with some of these costs. And if the cost is worsening relationships with the US and economic and some sort of economic pain, Xi Jinping seems to have made the decision that I will deal with that pain because this seems like an imminent threat to me and my stability and my sort of national stability. So I think they are saying that the cost is, whatever the cost is, we'll bear with it. The other thing is that it's interesting to see, right? You know, ever since Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo have said that Hong Kong is no longer autonomous and we might pull out the special status, it's interesting to see the PRC sort of spokespersons coming out and saying things like, well, this is interference in our internal affairs and, you know, the US is doing this. If you believe Hong Kong is like any other Chinese city, why don't you want the Americans to treat it like any other Chinese city? So there is a little bit of a, you know, strange sort of paradox in what the Chinese are saying. But my sense is that they've sort of accepted the fact that there will be costs. They're probably banking on the fact that not many countries will bandwagon with the US in imposing these costs on them. So the Europeans have been sort of trying to carve this strange middle path where they are being critical of things like human rights and this and that, but they are not shying away from imposing any costs. And talk is cheap. If you look at, you know, a couple of weeks ago, there was a report that before the announcement in Hong Kong that they, before the NPC was starting, there was an announcement by the spokesperson of the NPC in China that we will look to pass this resolution on the national security law. The law is still not passed. It's still in draft stage. And there's a resolution by the Chinese legislature saying we want to pass this law. And that's all that's happened so far. But when that announcement came that we are planning to do this, that this resolution will be tabled for consideration, at the same day, there were demarches sent by the Chinese to embassy to countries around the world. India was one of them. And they were basically told that, you know, we are going to be doing this. We hope you understand and we hope you take it in the right way. And we wouldn't sort of brook any interference. So they've clearly anticipated that there could be some action by countries and they've sort of therefore done this forewarning. America is taking a stand, Europe doesn't seem to be particularly taking any stand, the EU as a whole or individual countries. I don't see India or ASEAN or any of those other, you know, states taking a strong position on any one of these things. Their concerns would be primarily their population and their capital. So I think the Chinese have basically made a calculation saying there will be some costs. We'll deal with it. This is far more important. Securing this national security ambit because we fear secessionism, which could create political stability issues for the regime in mainland. I think that's the sort of calculation that they've made.
I can imagine that all these protests and all the statements that are being made by Europe without actually being backed by solid economic measures, right? I can see how they would really play into the narrative that China seems to be building in terms of its narrative battle with the West. I read this really interesting article in the Washington Post, which talked about how Russia's state-controlled media broadcaster, RT, has been increasingly coming out with a lot of like pro-China content recently, supporting Chinese stances on Hong Kong, basically saying that, you know, these are all things that are being misrepresented in the Western media. So I agree. It doesn't really seem like there are going to be concrete costs beyond the immediate stoppage of economic activity in Hong Kong when China is doing this.
If I can just add one more thing before we can go to Rohan. The cost that we will see for the regime is likely to come from within Hong Kong. it's likely to come from protests, and that will be a heavy cost to these protesters also, who will have to sort of, you know, who will be jailed, who's, you know, who will be tracked more stringently and all of that. But it's the cost that will come from people within Hong Kong, the kind of disruption that this could lead to within Hong Kong. I mean, that could blow up in Beijing's face. I don't really see external forces imposing economic cost being significant. Yeah, that's just the point that I want to
blowing up in Beijing's face sounds a little interesting. how do you see that playing out, Manoj?
No, I mean, just think of it like this, right? I mean, these are protesters who've learned how to be organized, who've, you know, yes, who will face grave risks to their lives in that system, but who've learned how to be organized, who've learned how to be subversive. And there is clearly a possibility that, you know, if, you know, these protests don't die down, and despite state crackdowns, if you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the street every other week, how many people will you arrest? And if those get increasingly violent and you radicalize even more people because of the way the state responds to it, yes, Hong Kong's economy is doomed, but Beijing doesn't also play out well. I mean, at the end of the day, tanks and armored trucks rolling down the streets of Hong Kong is a loss for Beijing. So anything where you have to escalate to that degree would be a loss for Beijing, because how long will you control it that way? So there are lots of ways in which this can play out really bad for Beijing also. But in none of the scenarios is it going to be good for the people of Hong Kong. It's going to be really difficult for the people of Hong Kong. Beijing's best hope would be that the fear that they generate by doing what they do through these methods of attrition and by imposing the national security law, they can clamp down on this will for freedom and democracy. But that's not an easy thing that will go away. So that's the challenge.
And that's a very good point. And I'm quite curious to see, really, because I think in a lot of ways, Hong Kong is it's kind of a lab almost for how a networked, digitally connected population can go up against arguably the world's most sophisticated tech authoritarian state. And keep it on its toes for quite a bit of time. So I think the entire world is going to be watching what happens here, not just in terms of what the PRC is doing, but also in terms of what the protesters are doing. I've been looking at the same GIF on Reddit over the last few days of somebody using a leaf blower, for example, to kind of control the flow of tear gas coming out from a canister. And you guys also talked about it in your research, which will be linked to in the description, about the new tactics that these guys are coming up with to kind of respond to the crackdowns the PRC is imposing. But thank you so much, Manoj. Rohan, any final thoughts?
I just want to add one more thing. Manoj has, I think, covered everything really well. Just one thing I want to add towards the narrative point here is that we saw during our research a bit of narrative contestation going on between the protesters and the state. That at this point seems either Beijing has lost out on the narrative contestation or simply has, you know, stopped caring about it. Your guess would be as good as mine. But the one thing that I will say is that the way in which this law has been introduced is actually, you know, as interesting as the law itself, because this is not this is basically being added as an annex to the basic law, so it doesn't have to be debated in a Hong Kong legislature. The idea is just to have it out there and just for Beijing to take this power into its own hands instead of actually deliberating it. And I just thought that this is perhaps the surest sign of this narrative sort of being just completely lost on Beijing, and they just want to go ahead with this, and they have considered the trade-off that come with, you know, going into Hong Kong like this, and they have decided it's worth it. So the way in which this has been done has been pretty striking to me. And that's just the only thing I wanted to add to this whole conversation.
All right. Thank you guys so much. The entire world is watching Hong Kong. As I said, there'll be a link to Manoj and Rohan's research on radically networked societies, the case of Hong Kong, in the description to this episode. Thank you guys so much for joining me. And thank you so much for listening to All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle, @TakshashilaInst, or our website, takshashila.org.in.